Good afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is April 4th, 2017, and today we will be hosting a public hearing on HB 5017. Before we get started on that, I'd like to ask LFO if he can kind of bring us up to speed. So, John, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee. The following is just a brief overview of what the general government subcommittee is going to face next. We're kind of transitioning to the next stages or the next phases of the budget process. If you recall, the co-chairs directed that three-phase process be followed. Phase one was just agency overview, their metrics, organization, budget, and that information along with public testimony. Phase two is kind of which we're entering will be more in-depth discussion of the budget issues, any issues that were held over from phase one, reduction options and things like that. And phase three will be agency work sessions. So phase two and phase three may also include policy bills. You'll have a public hearing on a policy bill, but you can expect more to be coming. And so, again, today you're going to finish phase one for all agencies and begin phase two and three. If you have any issues the sub-chairs have asked related to phase two that you would like addressed, please pass them to the subcommittee chairs and myself. We're compiling a list for their consideration, and then we'll let agencies know what their topics are. The subcommittee will be proceeding to phase three work sessions for some agencies during this period. In fact, you have four of them coming up this week on your schedule. You have two work sessions tomorrow and two work sessions the following day. The subcommittee will use work sessions to act on budget issues and key performance measures. LFO will provide recommendations and in the form of a summary memo and other documentation, including a KPM report and the amendment on OLIS, and those will be posted at least 24 hours in advance of the subcommittee. So, for example, real quick here is a measure for a Board of Accountancy. You'll see the LFO recommendation. You'll see the key performance measure summary with recommendations embedded within there. And then on the rest of the, then you'll also see the dash one amendment for the particular budget measure. So what the sub-chairs, co-chairs have asked is please review these documents in advance of the subcommittee meeting, and if you have any issues, discuss them with the sub-chairs. So all the work session recommendations have been pre-approved by the full Ways and Means co-chairs and the general government subcommittee co-chairs. At this point in session, recommendations are based on the full Ways and Means co-chair's budget framework. So the general government subcommittee co-chairs are required to balance to this framework at this time. However, the subcommittee co-chairs have also directed that a list of prioritized add-backs be developed too. The subcommittee on taking these work session actions will must follow the rules of the full Ways and Means committee. So just as a reminder, since the budget measures have been through public hearing and public testimony, work sessions do not generally provide for either public testimony or invited testimony unless at the invitation of the subcommittee co-chairs or by a majority of both the House and Senate subcommittee members. So in other words, the work sessions are usually moved quickly through during subcommittee. Voting by subcommittee members is by roll call if requested by any subcommittee member. So it's generally an exception rather than the rule. Most are oral roll call votes or oral votes. Co-chairs of the joint committee shall be deemed voting members of the subcommittee if need be. The subcommittee has the three Senate members and five House members. That means that two Senate members and three House members are required for quorum and reporting legislation to the full committee. The subcommittee does not have the power to hold or table any of the budget measures or legislation, but must report them back to the full committee. the Senate and the House co-chairs, the full co-chairs, at any time by joint action may remove a bill from the subcommittee and move it to another subcommittee or move it to full. The subcommittee members should, again, once the LFO, or once the posting has been noticed for work session, right around 24 hours in advance, read through all the work session documentation. For the small agencies, it's a quick read, of course. For the larger agencies, there'll be more extensive documentation associated with them. LFO, when they come in, will sit down and walk through their recommendation memo and the KPM recommendation memo in detail. And it's only an LFO recommendation at this point. There'll be no recommendation or analysis by the executive branch or the chief financial office. They've had their chance with the governor's budget. This is the legislative branch's opportunity to weigh in on the work session. Just a reminder of budget notes. They're to be pre-approved by the full co-chairs and, as a courtesy, the sub-chairs as well. LFO strongly recommends that you work with our office on any language on budget notes, because they can be tricky, and we've seen quite a few of them. And as on the orientation materials, as well as out on the LFO website, is a budget brief on budget notes that might be a good primer to go in and review what they actually are. And how they're to be used. Again, your LFO analyst is happy to work with you on those particular details. So if you recall from our initial orientation, what you'll be taking work session action on is the agency's primary budget measure, but that's not their final budget. So their final budget is comprised of several things. Usually the end of session bill, the omnibus bill, will make assessment changes. So DAS assessment changes, attorney general rate changes, and perhaps other changes to that bill, to the agency's primary budget. There will also be substantive legislation possibly that will go through that maybe will add dollars to that agency's budget. So there are more adjustments coming to these agencies' budgets that you will see. So you're just taking action on their primary budget bill, but you can expect further changes later in session. After phase three is completed, or after phase two is completed, and the state revenue forecast becomes known, then there'll be kind of a release of the larger agency budgets through subcommittee. We're about one-third, the subcommittee is about one-third of the way through its work. That's the phase one. We have about two-thirds of the session to go. So this phase two will be, again, the more specific agency topics and their reductions and policy packages. There'll be these work sessions that come through for the smaller other and general fund agencies. And then we'll move into the third and final phase of work sessioning all the remaining large agency budgets. So that's kind of a quick overview to expect for these next few months. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee?
I just have a little.
Your representative.
Thanks, Chair Manning. Am I to expect on a very small agency like the Board of Accountancy that we won't have another public hearing on them, that we'll just do a work session?
Co-Chair Manning and Representative Nierman, that's correct. An agency of this size has no major issues and will bypass phase two and go to phase three work session.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues, first of all, I'd share with you, LFO does a phenomenal job in their reviews, and so it really is worthwhile to go through and read the information they have in there. I would share with any of you, it doesn't matter which party, I also go through every single staff summary that LFO puts together on all budgets, and I'm more than willing to share my notes on that with anyone who wants it. I do it every Wednesday and Thursday evenings and have them ready for Friday morning for full, and so if anyone ever wants to see those, I'm more than willing to give them. They're not worth the paper they're written on, but I'm more than willing to share my observations.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So Now we'll open up a hearing on HB 5017, Commission on Indian Services. Ms. D. Pigsley and Karen Quigley. Welcome, and before you get started, please, for the record, state your name and.
My name's Dolores Pigsley, and I'm the chairman of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians of Oregon, and also the chairman of the Commission on Indian Services.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the commission. I am Karen Quigley, the executive director of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, your legislative commission. Well. Thank you. With your permission, I know that there are some new members here that may not be so familiar with the work of the commission, and some of you, please bear with us, who are very familiar with the work of the commission. If I could just take a couple of moments to remind us all about the political and legal status of the 9 federally recognized tribal governments in Oregon, and to just celebrate how fortunate we are in the state of Oregon to have had for 42 years, with the great foresight of people like the former governor Vic Atiyah, a mechanism and a forum for the state of Oregon to have ongoing communication with the other 9 governments that exist within the borders of this state. Supreme Court findings for hundreds of years have declared that tribal governments are domestic dependent nations. They aren't foreign nations. And they are dependent in terms of their relationship with the federal government. But what that means for the state of Oregon, you have neighbors, you have other governments within Oregon's boundaries that have jurisdictions that the state does not control, that there are some co-management authorities over land, water, air, that the state and the 9 federally recognized tribes have to figure out how to work together for the best of all Oregonians. And the commission provides that forum for communication and a place to figure out how to maximize the resources of all 10 of these governments and how to address issues before they become issues that need to be litigated in court, which is the experience of an awful lot of other states and tribes. And importantly, LCIS, the commission, allows for something that the co-chair heard about this morning, discussions about the unique feature of the tribes in Oregon in terms of their relationship with cultural resources. An awful lot of my responsibility has to do with designating appropriate Indian tribes. There are probably 25 state agencies that routinely seek my counsel, either because statutes require it, federal or state statutes, or their own programs and rules. The military department, the state police, Department of Education, the Water Resources Department, the Energy Department, where these agencies are required to consult with tribal governments before they undertake some action. And so the commission has a way for that assistance to be given in a way that is agreed upon by the tribal governments and seems to be something that works very well, and maybe the chair can speak to that a little bit. I think that what it might be helpful, and I've never done this before, so you can let me know if this is helpful to you. I thought I would describe the kind of contacts that I've had in just one day about 2 weeks ago. The first call in the morning was from the Redwoods National Forest in California, And they said that they were working on a condor reintroduction program in the entire historic flyway of the condors from Northern California through to Alaska. And how would you go about having a conversation with the tribes in Oregon about that project? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, the tribes in Oregon have been discussing that project. And they've had an awful lot of other activities that have dealt with both state agencies and tribes. The Oregon Zoo had a condor chick hatching program in which the tribes in Oregon were very closely involved. A tribal council member from Dee's tribe actually was one of the people that named the chicks and assisted with that program. There was a state archaeological permit that both the commission and the tribes were involved with that was studying caves throughout Oregon in order to get evidence of the condor's flyways. So the Redwood National Forest was fascinated to hear this, and I said, come talk some more with the tribal leaders and find out how each one of them would like you to interact with their tribal staff, tribal experts, for next steps on the program as far as it goes with Oregon. Likewise, there'll be state agencies here involved. Then I was visited by a lobbyist who was hired by a health professional association who wanted to start doing some serious work in Indian country, and specifically they wanted to make sure that their experience did not match what happened to them in a neighboring state. So we were able to discuss some strategies, one of which also included being invited to the next commission meeting to find out how tribal leaders and legislators on the commission might suggest that they have those discussions. Then a
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator?
If I could interrupt you for just a second, Ms. Quigley. Do you do any degree of initial vetting, or are you just handing out phone numbers? And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. Do you do any inquiry as to the individual seeking to do business in Indian country, whether they have the financial wherewithal, whether their motives are pure, whether they're paid up on, I'm going to channel Representative Gomberg, whether they're paid up on their taxes in Oregon, anything about their bona fides? Because what I worry about is that if they then come to the tribe through the commission, does that have your imprimatur on it in some way that says this is a reliable person to do business with the tribes?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator, yes, and I'm hopeful with my education experience and over 22 years of doing this that I have a pretty good feel for asking the questions that need to be asked. This specific association was tied to a legislative bill that was being introduced. I reached out to the tribal health directors to get some feedback.
Let me be more explicit.
Okay.
I understand tribal health would be easier to vet, but if somebody calls up and says, gee, I'm the panacea to all your casino problems, I'd like to come on down and chat about Indian gaming, what degree of due diligence do you do before you would turn them over to one of the sovereign governments to say, this is somebody you might want to talk to?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator, My first response to that is I avoid situations in which there appears to be an economic incentive, and I don't feel that's an appropriate use of the commission. And saying that,
that's probably
having to do with gaming, that's not a subject that I direct people.
That's more than adequate reassurance for me.
Okay, thank you. Going on, Mr. Chair, if I may, a college student who called who was doing a research paper and was trying to figure out why the government-to-government relations, state-tribal relations in Oregon were so much more effective than the state in which he was in and in other states in which he had studied. The Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services have hired an educational and training consultant to put together training materials that will be available to all state agencies on how to work with the tribes in Oregon. And they wanted my agreement to sort of review how they were approaching this, the development of this program. A university tribal liaison asked for some strategies about how to make the faculty and administrators more aware of the tribes in Oregon, and also to have a discussion about some possibilities for attracting more Native American students and retaining them, particularly from Oregon tribes. The Secretary of State's Audits Division came to talk to me about the fact that they were doing a performance audit of a natural resource agency, and they were wanting to know how they could get the input of tribal governments about the work of that agency with them. And I was able to talk about, because part of the state law requires state agencies to provide the commission with annual reports on what they've done with each individual tribe, so I could provide that. Again, an invitation to a commission meeting to have the direct discussion with leadership. Several times a day, I get a request to review permits that are required in statute for me to review to designate appropriate Indian tribes for archaeological permits. And my role ends with the designation of the appropriate Indian tribes, and then it's the tribes' review and their ongoing consultation about their requirements as far as that permit goes. The medical examiner's office has had a long-standing conversation with the Legislative Commission on Indian Services and Tribes about protocols for repatriation of human remains that come into the receivership of the medical examiner's office. There was a recent meeting, so that office was contacting me to give me a report on how that was going. One city in Senator Johnson's district and one in Co-Chair Smith's district contacted me on this same day about some infrastructure projects that they were doing, and the federal agency requires consultation with tribal government. So again, it's that role of designating the appropriate Indian tribe. My job is to assist state agencies, federal agencies, local governments to do what they need to do in terms of their responsibilities to consult with appropriate Indian tribes. So it's, who do you need to contact? How might you need to do that? How do you get the feedback or some additional help if you're not getting the response that you appear to need? At the request of the tribal cultural and health heritage director, I was asked to get some feedback about, I don't know if any of you happen to see, Oregon Public Broadcasting just had a documentary called Broken Treaties, and there is this understanding that the public at large may have some reaction to it, and this tribal member wanted to know, is there any strategy, is there any need for discussion about how that information is used or how a response is made to any anything that may come from people having seen that documentary and want additional information. And my last thing that I'll mention is a communique from a tribal government in Central Oregon just providing a resolution, so a piece of legislation they passed designating their intent to protect, to assert the importance of protecting a particular site, sacred site in Oregon. So that was just putting the commission on notice that this was something that was important to that tribe. So, Mr. Co-Chair and members, if we may go through this quick overview, and thank you, Michael, for helping me, and Teresa, thank you for all your help with the numbers and everything else here. Neither Dee nor I are aces at PowerPoints, so I am sure that Dee, is there anything you'd like to say about this information here?
Well, this information is a history of the Commission on Indian Services. It started out as the commission and was changed to the Legislative Commission. But we were very thankful to Governor Attia, he was senator at the time, for setting up the commission. And as Karen has said, she is the focal point. If anyone wants to contact tribes, they generally will be able, can contact Karen, and she's in instant communication with all of us on many issues. And these aren't just, I mean, we don't deal just with state issues, but with many, many other issues that that affect Indian tribes. And so this PowerPoint talks about the formation of the Commission on Indian Services and why it's important. And this was actually the gateway to the cluster meetings that tribes have with state representatives, which have been extremely helpful. And it's actually given us a lot of more information than we've ever had in tribal governments. And so it's produced some very good working relationships with state agencies.
Co-chair.
Oh, go to the senator then.
Senator, okay. Wait a minute. Senator?
Ms. Paisley, when you talked about the cluster meetings, some of us are unaware of what those are. And I forgive me if you described them in the beginning part of this presentation, but I don't know what their purpose is, their frequency, any of that.
And I don't know of a better name for them because that's what we've called them, but they're actually meetings called by the state agency with invited tribal participation. And so most of those agencies that tribes deal with have a tribal liaison, and some meet maybe four times a year, maybe some three times a year, some depends on what's pending. And I think probably the busiest one this year has been with Health and Human Services over many of the health issues that we all face together. But we call them cluster meetings. I don't know of a better word.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator, if I may add on a little bit, there was a law, a state tribal relations law, passed in 2001. And one piece of the law has to do with promoting communication between state agencies and tribes. There's some annual training, there's an annual summit, and the annual reports I spoke of earlier. In addition, it's unwritten in law, but has probably been the most effective implementation tool, are six clusters. And they were the original breakout sessions from our first annual summit in 1997. And so they are all the state agencies that have to do with, for example, natural resources. They are meeting on April 24th with the tribal natural resource directors. So they'll go over pieces of legislation that may be of interest of tribes, programs that tribes have that they work with state agencies on that another tribe may be interested in partnering with. There is a cluster that deals, as Dee mentioned, with Health and Human Services. There's one on economic development and community services, one on education and workforce training, one on cultural resources, and one on public safety.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Colleagues, I'd share with you, I've had an opportunity to serve on the commission, and it's really eye-opening. There's a lot of good work, a lot of collaboration, a lot of communication that occurs not only among the sovereign nations with one another, but also with the legislature. And so I compliment you on that work. I did have one quick question. In addition to this commission, are there other opportunities for the sovereign nations to come together and to discuss issues, or is this the primary avenue for that to occur? How else do the nations come together and talk?
Well, we have several organizations. There's an Oregon commission, not a commission, but the it has to do with tribes and, that have casinos, and then they participate. And then there's the Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest, which is all of the Northwest tribes. And then there's the National Congress of American Indians, which is huge. It's 650-some tribes. But we often have Oregon tribes meetings where we have specific issues that we talk to each other about. We also have specific issues that we do not talk to each other about. But what it does, and particularly with the commission, all of the issues that have come before the commission are issues that tribes are interested in, and we set the agenda so that we have people, speakers that come to us. We do not make decisions, and we're not a lobbying body, but we take that information back to our own tribes and determine what we want to do with that information.
Okay, thank you. I did forget about those two other.
And there's many other organizations, so it's a big world out there that you could go to a meeting every day if you really want to.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you for the good work that you folks do.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, I have always been very impressed. Understandably, all nations are not in agreement all the time, and there are many reasons why tribal nations may have disagreements with each other. I have been incredibly impressed with how collegial everyone is on the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. And again, the unique function it has that distinguishes it from organizations and associations with which tribes may be involved is this is something to work out the relationship specifically with the state of Oregon and tribal nations. And I think it's been very, very effective at doing that.
I agree. I don't know if you want to talk about the visuals, but I just pan through them.
Yeah.
It's important to recognize Karen's role in being the contact for many of the things, but particularly the archaeological ones, because there's a lot of misinformation out there and a lot of people that don't know what to do when a cultural event occurs that needs additional attention, and she's been very helpful in contacting. The tribes have certain areas that they're responsible for when archaeological things come up, and so Karen's able to get them to the right tribe with the right issue. So
Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Chair. Share with this committee, what's the protocol when legislation comes up, but there's not agreement among the sovereign nations? How do you folks handle that? Do you just let
We don't handle that at the commission. What we do is take that information back to our tribes, and we deal with it on a tribal basis. Because you'll find that there are many issues that we do not agree on with each other's position.
Hence sovereign.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Umberg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't want to interrupt the presentation, but just as a quick courtesy, I want to say it's very nice to see Ms. Pigsley here from one of the two tribes in my district. I apologize for being late. I was testifying in one committee about preserving our Coast Guard presence at the coast and another committee about celebrating the anniversary of the beach bill. So in two cases, I'm just trying to make it very clear, it's better at the beach.
It is. Was today. And I think the important part of this is the commission advises, but it's not an advocacy commission. And like I said, whatever information that we extract or whoever is making a presentation, it goes back to the tribes for the tribes to review and perhaps get more information and arrive at a position.
And if I may add, Mr. Co-Chair, how helpful it is to have four legislators on the commission, Senator Ferrioli, Senator Roblin, Representative McCune, and a soon-to-be-appointed additional representative. And the perspective they bring, and I hope that they share back with you as their colleagues, about effective partnerships in state-tribal relations. These employers in a lot of rural distress communities throughout Oregon, the incredible way that the cultural heritage of for all Oregonians is enriched by the expertise and knowledge, and having a good working relationship with the tribes in Oregon is there is a national reputation that the state of Oregon has and how well it works with tribes and vice versa.
And I would just like to say in closing that I appreciate, tribes appreciate the representatives that have come to the governor's summit and heard us speak. We always feel like we're just talking to each other, but it was the last couple of years, a lot of state people have been there and representative senators have been there, and it's very nice. Thank you.
Okay. From the committee, are there any questions, or do you have more? I don't want to cut you off.
No. You're done?
Okay. Oh, well, I saw another slide come up there, so I paused, so I didn't want to go ahead. If there are any other questions from the committee? If not, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will be closing the public hearing on HB 5017, and we will be opening a public testimony on HB 5017. And we have one person to provide public testimony at this time, and that is Sean. What is it, Sean Reed Cleve? And before we get started, sir, for the record, could you please state your name?
Absolutely, Co-Chair. For the record, Sean Cleve, representing myself today, not the Oregon Association of Realtors. I started staffing in the assembly during the interim of 1999. I guess you can start to tell from the gray in my beard that it's been a little while. I just wanted to take the opportunity today to share my perspective of the importance as just a staff person for the assembly and also a former chief of staff for a caucus office. First and foremost, as an assembly staffer, exceptionally difficult work. I graduated the Oregon State University. I had interned in 1999, came to work for a senator from Roseburg, Senator Bill Fisher, who a lot of you know fondly. I think I was paid fairly generously out of college, but, you know, as all those jobs do, you make ends meet and pay your student loan bills. These jobs are exceptionally technical. And by the time a citizen of Oregon comes to call on their assemblyman for an issue, they're usually at their last straw. It is usually somebody who's dealing with an issue with the Department of Human Services or whatever we have decided to call that agency this biennia. And it is difficult to build the networks that you need to create longevity and provide the successful resolution to the issues that arise on your desk. And I just hope that this committee, over time, I know the budget's really slim, will consider providing greater support, not just for the members, but for their staff in those positions as well. When we moved to a full-time legislative assembly, the work became full-time. It is year-round. Problems do not stop when we sine die. Luckily, we have a little bit more time in the building, but I think that we just haven't been able to keep up with the compensation we need to attract and retain the professional staff that we need to help the constituents that you all serve as members of the assembly. Secondly, as chief of staff for Representative Mike McClain 4 years ago now, You know, that was a very tough budget to manage. There are rules. They are often ignored on how to use the money. In the end, you try to make ends meet. I think that, you know, the one takeaway I'd have for the caucus office budgets is they are trying to provide supplementation for the lack of staffing that you all can afford during the interim. They do their best, but they can't always make the mark. A little plug for the House, even though I started in the Senate, they have twice as many members. So the caucus offices basically have twice as many contact points that they need to make in order to keep relations up and make sure that they're providing a good service to the members of the Assembly. Both of those budgets I hold dear to my heart and think that we could probably do better, not just for your outcomes, but for the outcomes of your constituents as well. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Good. Thank you. Are there any questions? No questions. Is there anyone else that wanted to provide public testimony on HB 5017? Seeing none. Thank you so much, sir. And we will close public hearing on HB 5017, and we will hold a public hearing on HB 2906 related to sharing geographic information. And we have Representative Co-Chair Nancy Nathanson.
We're the Blazer cheerleaders.
So, our co-chair, Representative Nancy Nathanson, can you hold telephone? Do we have anything that you want to start this off with?
We do, co-chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2906 is a committee bill introduced by the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. I serve as the committee coordinator for that committee, as well as an LFO analyst for information technology issues. The primary provisions within the bill were developed by a 24-member geospatial data sharing work group that was established and jointly sponsored by the JLCIMT and the State Chief Information Officer. The multi-jurisdictional work group was formed immediately following the 2016 annual session to comprehensively study the current practices, issues, barriers, and concerns, and to identify possible solutions to those barriers that prevent public bodies in Oregon from effectively and efficiently sharing geospatial framework data with one another and on a statewide basis. Based on that information, the work group was tasked with drafting suggested language for a legislative concept that work group participants could recommend for JLCIMT introduction during the 2017 legislative session. That collective work product is House Bill 2906. The activities of the work group were jointly led and facilitated by myself on behalf of the JLCIMT and the State Geographic Information Officer who works for the state CIO. Very quickly, House Bill 2906 does five primary things. It establishes an Oregon Geographic Information Council within the Office of the State CIO and specifies membership, purposes, and powers of this multi-jurisdictional council. It's important to note that this council has existed under an executive order since 2000, but the current membership is predominantly comprised of state agencies. So this bill will move the council from executive order status to a statutory body, and it will importantly expand and make the membership more representative of tribal, regional, county, city government, and special district entities across the state. House Bill 2906 will also require public bodies beginning in 2020 to share certain geospatial framework data under specified conditions and with specific limitations. The multi-jurisdictional council will determine what data is shared, how often it is shared, and under what data standards, and those standards will be adopted by the council. The delay in implementation is simply to give the multi-jurisdictional council some time to form up, to establish those standards, and to begin working effectively with public bodies across Oregon. The third purpose of the measure is to require the state CIO to appoint a state geographic information officer to oversee and manage the state CIO's duties and functions under the provisions of the Act. The state geographic information officer will report to the state CIO and support the council's activities. As this is a budget a committee, Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee, want to make clear that this is not a new position. This position is already established within the budget of the Office of the State CIO, but is not currently named in statute. The multi-jurisdictional partners felt it was very important to identify this position as a key support person for the council in the future. Fourthly, House Bill 2906 requires the State Geographic Information Officer to secure the geospatial data library, to protect the availability and integrity of the information within the library, and to provide secure electronic access to the library for purposes of sharing geospatial framework data. This, too, is already an existing responsibility of the State Geographic Information Officer, and the geospatial data library already exists through a partnership with the Oregon University institutions. Finally, House Bill 2906 establishes an Oregon Geographic Information Fund and appropriates monies in the fund to the state CIO for purposes of the Act. Establishment of this account is just that. There is not an appropriation associated with this bill. This establishment of the account will essentially create a place for counties, cities, special districts, et cetera, to pool monies for the purchase, management, and sharing of geospatial data in the future. It also, the establishment of the fund will enable the state CIO to go after and accept federal grants, donations, and other funding for the purposes of the council. At this point, we do have some invited testimony, beginning with Representative Nathanson and her role as the co-chair of JLCIMT. And we also have some additional presenters, but we'll get to them in just a moment.
Thank you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. First, I'd like to set the record straight. For those of you who know what I used to do in my career, I don't go around looking for bills that have the word library in them just so I can attach myself to some kind of work that has to do with libraries. You just heard an explanation of geospatial data and what the bill does, and it's very technical and very geeky, the kind of information you just received. It's very important. I would like to put a little bit of a real-world spin on it as I tell you, in my perspective, what the bill's about and why I think it's so important. First, I want to be sure we're all on the same page with what is geospatial data. It's any data set with a location element, such as an address, a tax lot ID, a milepost, or a latitude-longitude coordinate. The vast majority of information used in government at all levels, whether it's federal, tribal, regional, local, or state, can be referenced to a location in one way or another. This geospatial data is an essential component to the business of government in virtually every program area: public safety, natural resources, economic development, human services, transportation, and so on. I believe it provides some of the most foundational information we in government require to make better decisions, place-based policies and programs and services. Decisions by government that save lives, protect property, preserve wildlife and natural resources, and ensure sustainable development often have a crucial element in common. Success depends on reliable, accurate, and timely information, and sometimes that's geospatial data. Today, many decisions are based on the best available data, which unfortunately, right now, can be very poor and therefore causes a great deal of uncertainty. Or worse, potentially delay quick and effective response to emergencies that are threatening life or property. Often data is not available when it is needed, or it's inadequate for the particular decision. Even in more mundane applications, like planning a traffic detour, or routing school buses to save fuel, projecting school enrollment projections for facilities planning, determining public water supplies that may be at risk of contamination, planning for future water needs, or developing public infrastructure projects, or improving broadband availability in rural areas. The data just isn't there for lack of sharing. Although some progress has been made over the past decade or so, the progress has been slow, and agencies at all levels of government continue to duplicate the collection, management, and storage of data. There are also a variety of impediments that prevent data sharing between government agencies, such as the concerns regarding privacy or confidentiality, liability and risk, the use of intergovernmental agreements, and simply the bottom line cost of controlling, collecting, managing, and storing this big data set. As explained by the LFO analyst, the JLC-IMT made an initial attempt to address the issues through House Bill 4056 during the 2016 session. However, it became clear early on that more work with a broader set of stakeholders was required before we could really move forward. And that's why I think it is so remarkable and commendable that what you have in front of you now is a bill that acknowledges this isn't about just the state. It's about the state working with all of the local, regional, and tribal governments. This is very important work that everyone will do together. So in our roles, Senator Riley and I and the state CIO sponsored the formation of that 24-member multi-jurisdictional work group that you heard about. They studied issues, and I am pleased that after so many months of the stakeholders talking and rolling up their sleeves, what you have is a bill that really moves things forward for the whole state. The bill is designed to improve data sharing and strengthen the relationship between and the efficiency of all of those regional, tribal, state, and local governments and special districts that operate throughout Oregon. Thank you.
Senator.
Thank you. I think it's a great idea, but I've got a bunch of really down in the weeds, you opened the door, geeky questions. One of them is that I didn't hear either in Mr. McSpadden's preview of the bill or your testimony anything about the taxation function of DOR, the Department of Revenue. And having been over and observed their mapping and how singular it appears to be as opposed to other mapping, do you contemplate eventually that critical mapping would be pulled into this data set?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I'm going to rely on the LFO analyst. It is my expectation that all of the data that state agencies are using be done in coordination with, for example, in that arena with county governments. But the LFO analyst should be able to tell us.
Certainly, co-chair, members of the committee, Senator. The ORMAP program that is run by the Department of Revenue is working in close coordination with the current Oregon Geographic Information Council. The land ownership data, or cadastral data is the technical term, is one of the geospatial framework data themes that Mr. Cy Smith and Dean Anderson will be talking about in just a few moments. But certainly it is part and parcel of kind of the larger data themes that are covered under this bill.
If you'd permit, Mr. Co-Chair, two others. I've sat in this room now for biennia and yowled about the deficiencies of Scenic. We have now changed the name to protect the guilty, but it is now the State Data Center. And without going into huge detail here, I'm anticipating that the amount of data that you envision collecting will be voluminous. And my curiosity is whether or not the State Data Center is the proper repository. Is it set up? We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars there and don't have, I think the nomenclature is, the floor lit. I see knowledgeable people's heads going up and down. So that's a worry to me. And then last but not least, something else that has come up during the course of this session is the shared data that you speak of aspirationally. We have discovered that because cities and counties do not share data with ODOT in a consistent way, we have no way of measuring culvert conditions or other kinds of information. And when pressed, cities throw up their hands and go, we don't have any money, don't make us do it. Counties have fought back somewhat similarly, but with less vociferousness, if that's a word. Anyway, the point of my story is that as you start collecting this, you might want to think about a foundational platform so that everybody's reporting metrics look the same, can be compared to each other, can be overlaid on each other. And then if you'll let me have one more. I think you and I spent countless hours locked in the hermetically sealed room discussing Owen. I'm sorry to bring that back. It probably invokes PTSD, but I think it is only as we are coming to the end of that regrettable episode that many of us are becoming aware of how deficient the delivered OWIN was, the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. I'm sorry for using an acronym. That it's deficiencies in reality versus what was expected. And I think that this data for law enforcement that you're talking about as a resource could ultimately help feed into our duplicative 911 response system, or when you call 911 and you think you're talking to an operator who knows where the, you know, the State Street overpass is and they are down in Roseburg and don't have a clue. I think this is foundational work that may one day get us to systems that really do, as you pointed out in your testimony, save lives.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you've hit the nail on the head. That's what this is about. This is to put in motion what we know we've needed to do as a state for a long time. But I'm using the word state in a very general sense. I mean the community of the state of Oregon, all of the entities working together to share the information, to complete the task in the most cost-efficient way, but also to improve the way we deliver service to Oregonians. We should reduce duplication, but also fill those gaps where we don't have the information about the culverts. And you're absolutely right. The reporting metrics need to be standardized. I hope Mr. Smith will address that for you when he testifies.
One last one. I think I have not read the bill. I plead guilty and throw myself on the mercy of the committee. But I hope that the bill has sufficient fangs to compel participation. All too often, I have seen the situation of we're not going to play because we're little and we don't have any money. We're not going to play because our data is special and it needs to be housed differently. We're not going to play because it might cost employees down the line. I would just hope that if we're serious about this, and I include we in that comment, that if we're serious about it, we undertake this on a level that does not have a whole lot of self-identified off-ramps that allow units of government to be non-participatory because of how they deem their data as being proprietary or unique.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, thank you for that statement. That's my hope as well. And I know that this is something that was probably uncomfortable for the stakeholder work group to discuss initially, but as people talk and they come to learn about their shared interests, and everybody should have something to gain rather than looking at it as, oh, I need to protect my turf because I might lose something. How about I can gain something and you can gain as well? 2 plus 2 in that instance should equal 7 or 10 or 20.
That's because you see the glass half full, Madam
yes.
Co-Chair. Some of us are in the bottom, down with the dregs.
I am very hopeful, and I'm very appreciative of the stakeholder work group. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate the synergy that comes from this. I think this is a great idea. If I had a thought on this, I'm trying trying to be extraordinarily positive. I think the challenge on this is keeping the data updated. And so I would hope as we proceed forward, there's a methodology to have that mechanism in place to keep this updated. You know, a culvert that's located here today, all it takes is one work assignment from a utility, and the culvert's now on this side. And so I associate with Senator Johnson's comments, and I just want to add that keeping this data sharing updated is going to be a challenge. But at the same time, as I look at the fourth bullet point, it talks about that over $200 million is annually wasted in duplication. And so hopefully we can work to find the solution to always make sure this data is updated.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, thank you for that comment as well. You know, I was remiss in not pointing out one thing specifically that had been mentioned by the LFO analyst. The composition of the council is being changed with this bill. It's being broadened to acknowledge this isn't just about state agencies, and this isn't just about the state telling local government, we wish you would do this, or thou shalt. It changes the nature of that entirely. The council is broadened, and now it's a group of people coming together as equal participants on the council to accomplish this. And I think that will help a lot. So I hope that the people who speak after me address very specific issues such as stakeholder commitment, reporting metrics, the continuous updating, and other things that you've brought out in your questions. Thank you.
Can I just follow up really quick?
Mm-hmm.
I just think there's going to have to be some muscle with this. If not, it's so easy for someone to say, I'm busy. And next thing you know, the data's not up to date. And so I'm hoping we put that mechanism in place, because I do see the value in what you're trying to achieve here.
Yeah.
Senator?
I'm sorry, I had to step out for a second. I have transportation on the brain. One other interesting thing down the road, when there are future legislators contemplating future investments in transportation, I could easily see this as a platform to demonstrate what taxpayers are getting their money for. I've seen the ODOT displays of culverts throughout ODOT land, less so the cities and counties because they're not reporting with the same degree of accuracy. But how nice it would be to show in real data, this is where these culverts were, and with your investment, we fixed culverts A through F.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is part of it could be used as a transparency tool. It could be used in all kinds of different applications. But your fundamental premise that this is real-time data, this isn't guessing that there's a culvert at milepost 12, you know it's there.
Mm-hmm.
I've sort of let my imagination run wild. You could lift it up also with LIDAR at some point. I mean, this could be a pretty nifty tool if we set the foundation, have adequate rigor, as Co-Chair Smith says, adequate rigor to get participation fully realized. And I commend your effort. I think it's part of your suite of best business practices for government, and it's sure as hell long overdue, in my humble opinion.
Any other further questions for Representative, Co-Chair, and C. Nathanson? Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, I'd like to call up two folks here, Cy Smith and Dean Anderson. And gentlemen, before you begin, or when you do your presentation, please, for the record, state your name.
And while they're getting set up, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, and for those here in the room or those who may be listening, although today's public hearing involves invited testimony only, we do plan to work with the committee coordinator, John Borden, to bring this topic back likely next week for a public hearing with public testimony. And so there'll be an additional opportunity for other stakeholders to come forward at that time.
May I respectfully ask that as invited testimony you include cities and counties? They are, and perhaps a representative of the ports, I want to hear them on the record talk about their interest in being fully participatory. Way too often we have good ideas in this building that are discussed in public with a self-selected few, and they leave the hearing room and they get fragged out in the hallway. And I would like to have on the record some articulation of generalized willingness to be fully participatory.
Can we add to that utilities as well?
Oh, God, yes. That'd be a great idea.
Northwest Natural Gas, Portland General Electric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Certainly, Co-Chair Manning, members of the committee, Co-Chair Smith. We actually do have one of the work group members from a county government with us here today. Dean Anderson is one of the gentlemen there at the table with Mr. Smith. Next week, we do anticipate additional work group members that represent special districts and a variety of other partners that have been working with us over the last year or so to come forward.
DOR?
The Department of Revenue is a participant in our efforts, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that,
absolutely.
That could even extend out to public utility districts as well,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of those are out in the rural areas.
Very good.
Yes.
Very good.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Dean Anderson. I'm from Dallas, Oregon. I'm the IT director for Polk County, and I've been responsible for the county GIS program there for about the last 25 years. I'm also a long-term member of the Oregon Geographic Information Council. I appreciate being able to testify today. Thank you.
And co-chairs, representatives of the committee, my name is Cy Smith. I'm the state geographic information officer. I work for Alex Pettit, the state CIO. And I'm going to start the presentation off. Dean and I are going to kind of do a little bit of a tag team effort here. So he's going to jump in every couple of slides with some points. As Sean mentioned, Dean is a member of the stakeholder group that we've been working with. And let's see. So to start with, basically Sean and Representative Nathanson have taken all of our thunder. So I'm going to kind of breeze through this, and I'm sure you all will have specific questions and that kind of thing, and we can maybe have more of a discussion. But to start with, I want to mention to you what and explain what geospatial framework data is, what we consider that to be. It's 254 data elements, basically, that we've grouped into themes or buckets. And so the themes, we have 16 themes. You can see the themes here. Representative Nathanson gave you the definition for geospatial data. And the framework data is really what we're talking about with HB 2906. We're talking about sharing framework data, the foundational base data that everything else gets built on with all public bodies. So within these buckets, you've got a lot of individual data sets. The reason that geospatial data is and that concept is so important, really, you know, Representative Nathanson mentioned that it's possible to tie a location, to associate a location with almost any data that government uses. The reason that's important is because that gives you the ability to then tie all the information together to make decisions in ways that you couldn't otherwise. It's that, in database terms, it's that common key that lets you link databases together. Geography forms that foundation underneath almost all data, so that's why it's so important.
May I ask
yes,
a question? I understand all of those. Go back to the previous slide. I understand them all except bioscience. What's bioscience do for you?
Well, bioscience is primarily some natural resource data sets. It's species. It's where fish habitats are located. It's wildlife species. It's things like them.
Cool. Thank you.
Framework data is a trusted asset that supports many functions, from mapping water rights to flood mitigation to infrastructure management. As a local government, Polk County uses several trusted framework layers, including current and historic aerial photography, accurate elevation data based on Dogami LIDAR, water features as maintained by Oregon Department of Water Resources. We use this information combined with county-based features to support our many business activities. Using these trusted and documented data layers is a great way to reduce cost and provide our users with consistent and reliable information. That framework data set is built from many sources that includes many stakeholders, federal, state, tribal, city, county, universities, and others. As a local government, Polk County is a partner in building these framework layers. For example, we partnered with Dogami. We paid for almost half of the LIDAR collection in our county. Annually, we provide our digital road network information to ODOT, and we contribute to the state tax lot property framework later through the ORMAP program to Department of Revenue.
Senator? I'm sorry to keep bugging you guys, but it just as your testimony unfolds, it's reminding me of other stuff. The piece here that is worrisome for me is that as you collect this data, how to avoid individual agencies from running with it. I've got a kind of running gunfight going with Dogami right now. They've collected a lot of data, and they're making all sorts of independent judgments about how that data should be used. And it affects communities significantly. The Coastal Caucus has been visiting with them about you don't just collect all this LIDAR and then run out unilaterally and impose whatever your conclusions are from the data. And I share that with you only because if this layering is to be built up in a collaborative way, it ought to be used in a collaborative way and not siloed so that Dogami wakes up and says, gee, I think we'll change our inundation boundaries. Completely, in my view, arbitrarily. They already have inundation boundaries, and they've embarked on a plan to make them bigger. I think the Coastal Caucus has shared, and I'm sorry Representative Gomberg isn't here, but I think the Coastal Caucus shared how unhappy they were. The point of my story is to make sure that the data is interpreted broadly and not by the individual participants just having other people's information to bolster their own case, if that makes sense.
Okay, let's get an answer. Senator, co-chairs, members of the committee, I think one of the really cool parts for me of this bill is that it really looks at governance of the data. And in OJIC, as a member of OJIC for a long time, I think I was on the committee in 2000, or on the council in 2000. It's a state-centric committee. It doesn't have the ability to have that conversation. The way this is structured is there's two layers, if you will, of governance. One, there's OJIC as proposed, which is this multi-group. But then within each data set, so for example, LIDAR would have a data set that would have managers involved. So those folks that were looking at the broader issues would be able to come together and discuss and address those issues. So rather than saying, okay, let's come up with a bill to find money or what have you, I think the stakeholders really looked at it. How do we get to a structure that we can make decisions and address issues like what you've just talked about?
Thank you. So the point of this slide is to indicate to you that there's a lot of work to be done still. Sean had mentioned that we've had a council for quite a number of years. We've been doing a lot of work. Representative Nathanson mentioned that we've made a lot of progress over the last 10 years. But there's still a lot to do. So of the 254 data elements that we defined together in the community as framework data sets that we want to share, 116 of those are covered by a standard right now. We've got a lot of work to do still on standards. We identify standards as an entire community so that all the producers and users of the data have agreed that this is the standard they're going to use when they put the data together so that it can all fit. And you know, that's sort of the point that Senator Johnson was making earlier, I think, about reporting and standards. But we've still got work to do there. Only 47% are covered by a standard. Available from the Spatial Data Library, that's the OSDL, only 26% are available from the Spatial Data Library for folks to be able to download because they're the only ones that are complete. Available online as an ArcGIS service, available via the web for people to get to easily, only 15%. And then available from any source, only 30%. So there's a lot of work to do here.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess this is a question for our staff. Do we have a fiscal with this project?
Certainly. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Representative Smith, at this point, this is the first public hearing for this bill, and so a fiscal impact statement has not yet been developed for it. I would say that part of the reason the work group, the 24-member work group, has spent an entire year on this particular endeavor and on the language before you is to try to mitigate as many of the fiscal impacts as possible on all of the parties. In part, that's the reason for the delay in implementation on the mandatory data sharing until 2020. So there is an entire year or year and a half from the operative date of the bill, the council would be formed. These teams would be either formed, bolstered, or shored up to develop standards, to begin to identify the frequency with which data was to be shared, mechanism for sharing, et cetera, again, prior to that second operative date for mandatory data sharing.
Mr. Co-Chair, I would share with the committee, again, I think this is a great idea. As many of you know, I do economic development work, and much of this data we've collected already for certain counties that we work with, but to have it statewide is powerful. And I'll share with you, for business recruitment purposes, much of the needed information that companies have, it's out there, but it's spread out everywhere. And the notion that you could bring it all together is powerful for Oregon.
Senator Johnson?
When you get ready to price this, one of the things that I hope you take into consideration is doing some of the historic research that would underlie. What I'm thinking about is instances where DSL has showed up and asserted that something is a jurisdictional wetland. And you go back into the Grange Hall and you find the old map that shows a ditch that says, me and Fred dug this in 1923. That kind of information, the amount of money that we waste on regulatory stuff, if we can go back and build up some of this from known data, you're not adjudicating whether or not a ditch is a pristine salmonid habitat. And so I hope that you would take into consideration a few bucks to do the historic research.
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, the discussion that you've had with Representative Nathanson was really interesting. I've got all kinds of notes here, and it really gets back to the ideas that we were just talking about funding. If we're going to realize the vision of this that you all have kind of laid out just in the last little bit and that Representative Nathanson laid out, and make this data available across the state, we are going to have to figure out how to help local governments create the information, because there are lots of places where we don't have it right now. So it's going to be a key thing that the council will have to figure out how to do over the course of the next couple of years. And that, again, was why we've delayed this.
Senator Johnson.
One more. PSU has done an awful lot of research for the state across some of these layers of data. And I think that if we renew contracts with PSU, they ought to specify who owns the work product. Mm. I don't want to have to buy the data twice.
Fair enough. So on this, the last bullet here, Co-Chair Smith pointed this out earlier. The last bullet talks about $200 million being wasted. That's the main point of this slide, actually, and the rest of it has already been said. The way that you get to the $200 million wasted is by recognizing and accounting for how much money we spend now as a state, not just state government, but state and local government combined, on geospatial data. And we did a study in 2006 and 2007 on this. The council did a study and determined that as a state, and with state and local combined, we spend $5.4 billion every year on geospatial data. That's how you get to $200 million wasted. It's a significant number. It was, at the time, it was about 10% of the total state budget. It was 5% of the total state and local budget combined. So it's a significant amount, and it's because almost all the data that we all use is geospatial data. These are some of the problems that have already been brought up, that the reasons why local governments and state agencies don't want to share information with each other a lot of times: privacy and confidentiality, liability, cost recovery, the ability to pay for the data, the development, the management, and the maintenance, not just the sharing of the data. The fact that the governance has not been, it's been state-centric for the most part, so we weren't making decisions together about how to do this. And then the effectiveness and use of intergovernmental agreements has been problematic. If with 254 data elements produced by 1,000-plus jurisdictions across the state, it's impossible to have that many agreements around all of this data with all of those providers. I've tried, but it's just not possible to do that. There are too many connection points to be made. It's not an effective way to do this. Sometimes you have to have intergovernmental agreements to make the issues go away or to resolve some of the issues, but to have an agreement about every data element with every jurisdiction is not a
a sustainable way to do this.
Johnson?
Can we build into, and I don't know the answer to this, can we build into any contracts for construction going forward the requirement to provide some of this information? I'm thinking, I sat on the school safety task force, and we were talking about what geospatial data existed for schools that could be accessed easily by law enforcement if there were, God forbid, an active shooter situation. And I'm just wondering, rather than trying to go back and spelunk through ancient history, if we could at least draw a bright line and going forward capture data that might be germane to this undertaking.
Well, co-chairs, Senator Johnson, I think that's a good idea. That is, I believe, absolutely something that we would do. Once we've got the foundation and the statutory authority to do this, then any time a public body is using public funds to create these kinds of data sets, then it would be mandated that they be shared. So I think that's appropriate. So, Dean, this next one is you, I think, right?
Correct. I think as you talk about some of the issues with cost and mandatory issues, the committee wrestled with those because those are tough issues. And one of the things that we really focused on within that process is making sure that the stakeholders included collectors, folks who are building the data sets, integrators, folks that are, as well as folks that are using it. We met every 4 to 6 weeks. The issue identified, we're used to develop this bill. As one of the local government participants, I appreciate the willingness of the committee members to hear and act on the concerns of local governments have when we're building, sharing, and using framework information. Keeping those open lines of communication with stakeholder communities, informing them of the direction and status has been another important component of our efforts. So, for example, making presentations to the IT directors, to the assessors, to the assessor cartographers, were all very important pieces of this, and listening to their concerns. I appreciate the openness our facilitators, Cy and Sean, have had to this process and the many suggestions the various committee members had. It was a good process.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can you just give me one example? Previous slide, if we can go back to the previous slide. Can you just give me one example of a piece of information as it relates to data sharing that we'd want to keep private or confidential? I just need an example. I can't visualize what that would be.
Well, we have a couple in statute right now. Ownership information within public records law. There are a number of avenues where that information can be withheld from the public for public safety. I'm being stalked. I don't want people to know where I live.
Thank you.
Another one is I'm a law enforcement officer. Okay. Those sorts of things.
Okay, thank you. I just couldn't visualize what that would be. Thank you, Mr. Kutcher.
There's also threatened and endangered species. The ladies who were up here before us about artifacts, archaeological sites. Things like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. When we first started doing this, counties started adopting LIDAR on floodplains, and I can't tell you the problems were created because all of a sudden the banks started requiring floodplain insurance with information that was not accurate, and it cost people fortunes to get rid of the floodplain insurance and to have surveys to prove they were not in a floodplain. So we should be cautious and some kind of a oversight. So, thank you.
That's a good point. And they admitted they were wrong and didn't care. Mm-hmm. FEMA.
And you did that.
But the banks couldn't waive it.
So I am not going to read through this slide again. This is part of the thunder that Sean stole from us. He read through all this for you. I don't need to necessarily read through this. I don't think there were any additional points. Maybe that last bullet. We really did spend a lot of time trying to address these impediments within the stakeholder work group. And I think we've done a pretty darn good job of doing that with our partners. We really have formed a new partnership between public bodies around this effort. So I think, providing certain exemptions from liabilities was one of the key elements that we needed to get to.
Okay. Mr. Smith, if we can, we're just about out of time, and I know that other committee members have other obligations, so we can kind of wrap it up.
Practically finished.
Okay.
This is the last.
So the whole idea with this is to expand the stakeholder base so that when we're getting together, we're not having an us and them. It's all of us, which is on the right. And Cy and I don't often agree on lots of things, and this gives us a chance to be at the table together and have that conversation.
And there's our contact information. So with that, we're finished.
Okay. Committee members, we're at the witching hour right now. I know you got a lot of things that to take care of. But there was one other person that was signed up for this, but I think that we're going to be calling in for additional public testimony and comment next week. And with that being said, if there are no other questions or anything like that, we will adjourn and reconvene tomorrow, 1500 hours. It's 3 o'clock for civilians, and we are adjourned. For civilians, and we are adjourned.